efforts are underway to evacuate civilians from the besieged Ukrainian port city of Mariupol.
We don't know yet how many people would be able to get out from Mariupol, from Azovstal plant particularly, but hopefully no less than yesterday.
Plus the challenges prosecutors face holding alleged perpetrators of war crimes accountable.
Even now, women, they're scared to speak because they actually think that these murders, these rapers can't come back.
And later in the program, how a San Francisco area nonprofit is working to send easily operated and low-cost incubators to Ukraine. Today is Monday, May 2nd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian officials said they expect more civilians will be able to evacuate from the besieged city of Mariupol on Monday. President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a video message that more than 100 civilians were able to leave on Sunday and that they were due to arrive on Monday in Zaporizhia, which is located some 200 kilometers away. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv about the efforts to move civilians out of the besieged city.
UN and Red Cross and Ukraine managed to agree with Russian side and to start the evacuation process. Basically, it started yesterday officially, and yesterday it was 100 people were able to evacuate from Mariupol. They were evacuated by the representatives of the Red Cross and the UN, and followed by the Ukrainian soldiers, but of course Ukrainian soldiers just helped them to get on the buses. What we know that they were brought to the places of so-called filtration points where Russian soldiers made certain, you know, like let's call it interviews and checks. And then Red Cross and the UN were able to take them further to the Ukrainian controlled side. So people have already arrived to Zaporizhia, all 100 of them, mostly children and women and old people. And today they will get all needed help, medical help and humanitarian help. What we also know, today evacuation continues and it already started. We don't know yet how many people would be able to get out from Mariupol, from Azovstal plant particularly, but hopefully no less than yesterday. And also we know that today's evacuation process is a little bit wider than yesterday. So there will be two additional stops after Mariupol on the way to Berdyansk, and also civilian cars are allowed to join.
And as you mentioned, we're still waiting official word on Monday as to how many civilians were evacuated from Mariupol and the fate of those 1,000 or so who have been reported holed up there in the steel plant there. I want to switch gears really briefly and talk about the fighting elsewhere in Ukraine, and especially the explosions that have been reported near Odessa.
Yes, Odessa region is under severe attack for the past 2 weeks in particular, because basically this is one of the most important points in the south for Russian forces. And the city of Odessa itself was attacked a lot of times. And for the past 3 days, there were at least 3 attacks on the area of Zatoka, or particularly on the bridge which connects the city of Zatoka, let's say the seaside of Zatoka with Odessa region. And this is a very important logistic bridge. Ukrainian side made everything possible to ensure that the logistics continue, and they restored the breach very quickly, and today it was the third attack. We don't know yet the situation with the breach, so either it's working or not. There is no official information yet, but we know that the officials, Ukrainian officials, are doing everything possible to continue the logistics, so it doesn't really hurt military and civilians. Very important to mention that today Ukrainian forces managed also to destroy 2 additional warships in the Black Sea, which is also a very important operation, because these warships basically were supposed to attack Odessa from sea.
Anna Chernikova is reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, again, thank you for your reporting.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
The United Nations Human Rights Office said on Monday that the death toll of civilians killed in Ukraine since the start of the Russian invasion on February 24th had crossed the 3,000 individual threshold. The OHCHR said that the real toll was likely to be considerably higher. Ukraine says the Russian offensive is stalling on the Eastern Front as troops see heavy losses. AP correspondent Naomi Shannon has that update.
The General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine said in a Facebook post that their army has managed to keep hold of the Sloboda and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine. Russian advances are slowing down as they tackle human and material losses. But losses are heavy on both sides. In occupied areas, Ukrainian intelligence officials say that Russian forces have destroyed medical infrastructure and are denying medical care to residents. And the defense ministry claims that Moscow has taken over medical centers in Kharkiv region to treat its own wounded troops. I'm Naomi Shannon.
U.S. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, who along with six other Democratic lawmakers, made an unannounced visit on Saturday to Kyiv to meet with President Volodymyr Zelensky, held talks on Monday with President Andrzej Duda in Poland as she pledged support for NATO allies and their efforts to booster Ukraine against Russia. VOA Eastern European Bureau Chief Mirosława Gongadze spoke with Speaker Pelosi in Warsaw, Poland.
Poland is most active defender of Ukraine today in the European sphere, and Poland is asking for more sanctions, specifically as well as seizing the assets of Russian assets in European Union. Is United States supporting that Poland push for that?
We've passed legislation this week in the Congress of the United States under the auspices of our members here, Mr. Meeks, Mr. Chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, to seize and freeze the assets and to use those assets to rebuild Ukraine and to help the people of Ukraine.
Do you think the European Union should do a similar act?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
As well as you mentioned yesterday about the bully and Russia as a bully.
Yeah, yes, that was in response to a question that says if you do this, well, they may do that. Well, I don't think I think they have done enough to justify the strongest possible military response, the strongest sanctions to make the case that this is not tolerable. And again, all the humanitarian and economic assistance that we need to put there. And we shouldn't do anything less because of a threat from Russia. They have already delivered on their threat. They've killed children and families, civilians and the rest. And as I said yesterday, we don't respond to a bully.
Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, speaking with our Eastern European Bureau Chief, Mirosława Gongadze. Chernihiv residents began clearing debris from their homes in a bid to rebuild their lives after suffering from heavy Russian military activity. Reuters' Ilan Rubens reports.
Houses and structures in the city, around 100 miles northeast of Kyiv, were destroyed from heavy shelling. This was before Russian forces sharply scaled back their military activity in the area in late March. Residents are now slowly starting to think about rebuilding. For 77-year-old Anna Selivan, this will be an uphill journey. She has no family left, except a grandchild that pays her visits. The roof of her small home was entirely destroyed by airstrikes, and she is now slowly clearing her home, one small trolley at a time. Russia calls its actions in Ukraine a special operation to disarm and denazify Ukraine. Ukraine and its Western allies call that a baseless pretext for a war of aggression.
Ilan Rubens from Reuters News. The International Organization for Migration is fixing up many damaged and unused buildings to house nearly a million Ukrainians forced to flee their homes in the wake of Russia's invasion. Lisa Schlein has that story.
The first phase of this program has been rolled out in the Zakarpattia region in western Ukraine. UN migration spokesman Paul Dillon says IOM and its partners began the shelter rehabilitation program several weeks ago in response to the number displaced by the invasion.
7.7 million people internally displaced within the country. This represents about 17% of the pre-war population, and an increase of some 1.2 million since the first report was released in the third week of March.
Dylan says work is underway to rehabilitate university student dormitories and war-damaged hotels to provide safe accommodations for roughly 1 million homeless people. He says windows, doors, and roofs are being replaced. Electrical systems are being rewired. Sanitation facilities are being improved, and temporary partitions are being installed for privacy.
We do not see these particular facilities as being permanent structures. This is they're temporary measures to provide a safe, a secure, and dignified environments for people to live in. And we are looking at those who are most vulnerable. We're looking at single parent headed households, people who have disabilities, or people who are helping those with disabilities.
The program initially will cover the 5 western regions of Ukraine. Dylan says these regions are the primary destination for newly displaced people because they are seen as safer than areas where fighting is more intense. He says the shelter rehabilitation program may be expanded to other regions depending on the need and the security situation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The Pentagon on Friday blasted the conduct of Russian troops in Ukraine, saying, quote, "It's very clear that Russian forces have committed war crimes," end quote. From Friday's press briefing, Press Secretary John Kirby.
It's difficult to look at some of the images and imagine that any well-thinking, serious, mature leader would do that.
VOA's Amy Katz explains the legal definition of war crimes and the avenues to hold those accountable.
War crimes are violations of international humanitarian law. Intentionally targeting civilians, using child soldiers, and committing acts of torture and rape are war crimes. No single document codifies all war crimes. However, the core principles of international humanitarian law are enshrined in the Geneva Conventions, most of which came into effect after World War II, and the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court, or ICC. Intention is a necessary component of a war crime. For example, shelling a hospital by itself is not a war crime, but doing so intentionally or recklessly would be. ICC. The ICC is charged with prosecuting individuals for war crimes and for crimes against humanity, such as genocide. While Ukraine is not one of the court's 123 members, it has granted the ICC jurisdiction. The ICC's chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, said in February that he would investigate suspected atrocities in Ukraine. Based on the court's findings, it could prosecute individual Russians for war crimes, but could not investigate the Russian state for crimes of aggression. That is because Russia, like the United States and China, has not signed on to the ICC. The ICC also cannot try people in absentia. So Russian suspects could not face trial unless they were physically present in the ICC's courtroom. Other options. Individual countries could prosecute Russian officials or military personnel for violations of international law under the legal concept of universal jurisdiction. Such cases, however, do not usually lead to enforceable punishments for the perpetrators. In addition, many national laws prohibit the prosecution of sitting heads of state, such as Russian President Vladimir Putin and senior government officials. Another option would be to establish a tribunal such as the one in Nuremberg, Germany, created after World War II to prosecute Nazi war criminals. Tribunals were also used to convict individuals of genocide and other charges following violent conflicts in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda.
VOA's Amy Katz. Moscow has repeatedly denied that it is targeting civilians. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias recently spoke with Ukraine's Prosecutor General, Irina Valentinova Venediktova, via Skype about the efforts Kyiv is undertaking to collect evidence against Moscow and its alleged atrocities. The conversation began by Venediktova explaining the efforts currently underway to catalog war crimes and suspected criminals.
We now, for today, have all evidences to start to prosecute these people. And, of course, our suspects in this crime of aggression, they are in Russian Federation. It is the top level of politicians, militaries, and top propaganda agent. And we will go in absentia to start to prosecute them. I think it's very perspective for us, and we will be successful in the court, because it's so objective and we have a lot of evidences. From other side, we understand that for us, for Ukrainian citizens, it's very important to have the same verdicts in the international sphere, actually, because our approach is go to national jurisdictions. It's very good. Our priority and other approach, it is war crimes. We have huge number of such cases, and every day the figure grows up and grows up. Today it is more than 8,600. And of course, it is typical war crimes what we have in Ukraine. Bombing and attacking civilian objects, then killing civilians, torturing, raping, and so on. We are moving through this one, and we have first our suspects. For example, we started to prosecute concrete 10 Russian Federation militaries who were in Bucha, who tortured people. I understand that it's only beginning. Now we on the process to start to prosecute people who killed civilian in Bucha. And our third approach, it is actually genocide. We started this proceeding from first days of war. We look all proveness and we collect all evidences about this. We have qualification of genocide in our criminal court, and we understand the strategy how we should to investigate. But this is very difficult because we don't have access to the territories where we see departure of children. For example, Mariupol, Donetsk, Lugansk regions. That's why for us very important to have access to these territories, of course.
Could you comment, please, on reports of rapes of children, which, correct me if I am wrong, but would constitute a war crime? And explain, please, how you plan to gather and secure the evidence as well as bring the alleged Russian perpetrators to justice if the Ukrainian government, even in times of peace, have found it challenging to prosecute their own citizens accused of rape, according to different NGOs we have interviewed.
We have this tragic experience about sexual crimes which were actually on Donbass 8 years ago. It was occupied territory of Ukraine, and we have this experience how to investigate such categories of crimes. Actually, we have methodology which were created by NGO and international experts. And of course, we all understand that now we have huge number of such sexual crimes. We know it from operative information. But again, I'm a prosecutor. I can speak about concrete cases when I start to prosecute people. We started to prosecute people, a concrete person who raped the woman. About children, we have this operative information. Children, old women, and men. But again, when we start to prosecute, I can give you information. Now, I spoke with a lot of NGOs and actually do very often coordinational meetings with national police, with Ministry of Justice, with Ministry of Health, and with other our Ukrainian non-government organizations. And we all understand that when the war will be finished, when in Ukraine we can create such circumstances that our victims will be safe, we will have huge number of these cases. because even now, women who are on the territory of Kyiv region, they are on the territory of Ukraine, but they are scared to speak because they actually think that these murders, these rapers can't come back, and they're scared. They under huge stress. That's why we should wait when war will be finished and when our victims will be ready to speak with law enforcement agencies.
Irina Valentineva Venediktova is Ukraine's prosecutor general, and she was speaking with VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias. A San Francisco-based nonprofit is working to send easily operated, simply maintained, and low-cost incubators to Ukraine. The devices are already saving lives in the developing world. Craig McCulloch reports the creator is hoping to save thousands of babies being born in bomb shelters or without access to operating hospitals in Ukraine.
After learning some 260,000 women in Ukraine are pregnant, with many now giving birth in bomb shelters or without access to modern medical care, Embrace Global is working to send 3,000 of their incubators to war-ravaged areas of Ukraine. Co-founder and CEO Jane Chen launched the initiative at the recent TED 2022 conference in Vancouver. They're already sending 200 with UNICEF. While traditional incubators require continuous electricity, these devices, which look like small sleeping bags, can be charged like a cell phone with electricity or a heater that works off hot water. The charge lasts up to 8 hours.
The core technology is a pouch of a wax-like substance called a phase-change material. And so this, once melted, can maintain the exact same temperature of 98 degrees of human body temperature for up to 8 hours at a stretch, and it can be reheated thousands of times.
Each device costs between $300 and $400, substantially cheaper than the $20,000 for a basic traditional incubator, which also requires continuous electricity and trained personnel. The low-cost incubators require virtually no training and are designed to be very simple to use. Chen developed the device while attending Stanford University and after then spending 4 years in India, where they have been distributed to 12 states. She says the war in Ukraine is creating a new use for it.
This is a really ideal solution actually for a humanitarian crisis like this because of the fact that the incubator is portable and it works without stable electricity. And on top of that, you don't need a trained caregiver. The training for this is extremely simple. It was made to be very intuitive to use, so it can be used in those types of situations.
This is the first time Chan and her organization have sent the incubators to Ukraine. Besides India, the incubators are also being distributed through parts of sub-Saharan Africa, Afghanistan, and Nepal. Dr. Gita Arora is a New York City-based internist and loves the fact that the incubators can be used so easily in the developing world.
My family comes from a very poor part of India, and there's nothing available. And most babies have to be, if you're even trying to wrap or keep their bodies warm, you have to wrap them or strap them to another body to try to keep them warm. But with this, you know exactly what temperature the baby's going to be.
For Chen and Embrace Global, the ongoing challenge around the world is getting people on the ground to make sure the incubators are getting to the right places and people. This was recently the case in Zambia.
And it was a nurse at a government facility who reached out to us who was just really passionate. She was seeing the number of babies that were dying because of a lack of incubators, and so we sent incubators to her. She, as the champion, really brought it to the attention of all of the hospital staff, and with that we were able to expand it to other hospitals in the area.
In a little over a decade, Chen estimates Embrace Global's incubators has already saved the lives of 350,000 babies around the world. Their goal is to save 1 million and then have the product available to everybody who needs it. Craig McCulloch for VOA News, Vancouver, British Columbia.
And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of our entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.